Part 9 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on loving kindness with Jack Kornfield.
Central to the possibilities of awakening, this Buddhist psychological teaching of the human potential for awakening, or the heart of a Buddha within us, are teachings called the Four Sublime Abodes. And these are the experiences of the heart that can be discovered or open to even in the midst of difficulties. Even in the midst of the most grave difficulties of the world, these are called the abodes of the gods. Their translation is sometimes the God-like states within us. And they are loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, or balance, heart and mind. And they each come as a natural result of presence, as we meditate here in the sitting, becoming mindful or aware or present, there comes a kind of opening. And in that opening of our attention, of our body as it opens, of feelings, history, and beyond that, mind and the whole of life that we open to, there comes naturally a sense of compassion and ease, balance and loving kindness. So I'll take each of those, starting with loving kindness, metta, which literally translates as friendliness, basic friendliness toward oneself and toward others. Yet even that we find difficult. It's very easy if one does meditation or has some spiritual life or practice to set up a set of ideals of how we're supposed to be and continue the conflict that we might have at work or in our families or driving or the worldwide kind of conflicts in our spiritual life. The good part of us hates the bad part of us, judges it, criticizes, wants to fix it and make it better and get rid of it and put it on a diet and, you know, you know what I mean, right? Tame it. And so forth. And so we get inside of ourselves, trying to make ourselves better, still at war. The principle of metta, or friendliness, is so central to spiritual life that in some ways it's almost all of it. And the ground of that is self-acceptance. Loving things as they are, including that very difficult task of ourselves. Because there's so much judgment and criticism and conflict and war within us. Can we love things as they are? A teaching that comes from one of my favorite friends and Dharma teachers, Ed Brown, the Zen cook, entitled Biscuits Beyond Compare. When I first started cooking at Tassajara, remember Ed's the author of the Tassajara bread book and all those things. When I first started cooking at Tassajara, I had a problem. I couldn't get my biscuits to come out the way they were supposed to. I'd follow the recipe and try variations, but nothing worked. These biscuits just didn't measure up. Growing up, I had made two kinds of biscuits. One was from Bisquick, and the other from Pillsbury. For the Bisquick biscuits, you added milk to the mix and then blobbed the dough in spoonfuls onto the pan. You didn't even need to roll them out. The biscuits from Pillsbury came in a kind of cardboard can. You wrapped the can on the corner of the counter and it popped open. Then you twist the can open more, put the pre-made biscuits on a pan and bake them. I really liked those Pillsbury biscuits. Isn't that what biscuits should taste like? Mine just weren't coming out right. It's wonderful and amazing the ideas we get about what biscuits should taste like, or what a life should look like ours. Compared to what? Canned biscuits from Pillsbury? Leave It to Beaver? People who ate my biscuits could extol their virtues eating one after another, but to me these perfectly good biscuits just weren't right. Finally, one day came a shifting into place, an awakening. Not right compared to what? Oh, my word, I've been trying to make canned Pillsbury biscuits. Then came an exquisite moment of actually tasting my biscuits without comparing them to some standard. They were weedy, flaky, buttery, sunny, earthy, real. They were incomparably alive, present, vibrant, in fact, much more satisfying than any memory I had. These occasions can be so stunning, so liberating, these moments when you realize your life is just fine as it is. You are just fine as you are. Thank you. Only the insidious comparison to a beautifully prepared, beautifully packaged product made it seem insufficient. Trying to produce a biscuit, a life, with no dirty bowls, no messy feelings, no depression, no anger, was so frustrating. Then savoring, actually tasting the present moment of experience, how much more complex and multifaceted, how unfathomable. A thought, a feeling, ants crawling on the ground in sunlight. As Zen students, we spend years trying to make it look right, trying to sit right, cover up the faults, conceal the messes. We knew what the Bisquick Zen student looked like, calm, buoyant, cheerful, energetic, deep, profound, loving. Our motto, as one of my friends said, was, looking good. We've all done it, trying to look good as a husband, a wife, or a parent, trying to attain perfection, trying to make Pillsbury biscuits. Well, to heck with it, I say. Wake up and smell the coffee. How about some good old home cooking, the biscuits of today? Handle each ingredient with sincerity and wholeheartedness. The results will take care of themselves. Then he leaves the recipe that you can look for elsewhere. So the ground of this capacity, this quality of loving kindness is respect for this amazing thing that we are, this life. Zen Master Suzuki Roshi used to talk about meditation as a kind of bakery. You'd sit down again and again. It was like baking bread in the oven, and you do sitting after sitting, like putting loaves of bread in the oven. And gradually, good smells would come into the kitchen by doing it over and over, not by your will, not by trying to make yourself somehow different, but by love. By kindness, by letting go, by a respect for what is. One of the teachers that I treasure and studied with is an old woman in Switzerland who died a few years ago named Dora Kalf, who was the originator of sand play therapy, those sandboxes and all the little figures. And when she was growing up in Switzerland, actually, I think it was during the war and right afterward, she came to be friends with Carl Jung and took care of his children. And he noticed that she had a way with children. And so at one point, he suggested that she study Jungian analysis and work with children. So she became the first child analyst in the Jungian tradition. She went and studied with a variety of teachers who used little figures and ways of working with children, and then developed this sand play therapy. And when I went to see her, she was in her 80s and was really an old, wise woman. And you go into her house, which was along the lake south of Zurich in Zollikon, and the house dated back from the parts of it from the 15th century, parts of it from the 10th century. It's great old Swiss house. Go into the back of the house near where the barn was that you could see still there were animals. And in this room were several little sandboxes and shelves on the walls with 10,000 figures of everything from life. Trees and mountains and soldiers and animals and cars and every kind of thing in miniature. And she sat there, and it was time to begin, and I said, "What do you do?" I mean, I kind of knew, but I wanted to hear her instructions, and she said, "Whatever you like." Wow, what an instruction. Huh? And so I started to make scenes in the sandbox. Scenes of mountains and fires and gorillas and angry animals and dinosaurs and scenes of temples and all kinds of scenes, babies, amazing scenes. And they just came out of me and they had nothing to do with the mood of the day. It was quite interesting. I went in one day after I'd had a kind of difficult encounter with a close friend, a kind of argument. Thought, well, it'll be an angry scene. Not at all. It just continued from the last time. It was as if some very deep place in me was doing this. In fact, it felt like I might have waited lifetimes to be in the presence of a person who just sat there as a wise woman, as she did, who said, when I asked, "What should I do?" "Whatever you like." Mm-hmm. That it was lifetimes of waiting for a place that some part of my psyche or being, this deep part, could just come out in whatever form it needed to. And when she spoke about her work, she said the most important thing of all is not one's understanding or interpretation. The most important thing is to create a truly free and protected place for this work of the heart, of the spirit, to take place in. In Buddhist psychology, again, the quality of metta, or loving kindness, is so central. We begin with ourself, because the psychology also teaches us that we contain everything. And until we can sense everything within ourselves, we'll not be at peace with the world. It's all there. I remember being on a retreat quite a few years ago, probably 15 years ago, and teaching, and it was just the last day of a 10-day retreat in Massachusetts. And I promised that on the last sitting, I would come in and lead a loving kindness meditation for everyone. So it was a bit before that, and I got a phone call from my girlfriend at the time, and we had a fight on the phone, and she was wrong, of course, and I told her so, and she was really upset at me for the demands that she said I was making on her, and I was telling her how closed she was and how neurotic, and we sort of went back and forth, and it escalated until finally I heard the bell was ringing, it's time to go into the sitting, loving kindness time, right? And I said, "Sorry, I have to hang up, I'll talk to you later." But we were really in it, and it was very painful. And I went in to meditate, and here's 100 or however many people, and they just done their 10 days, and they're all sitting there. Retreat's over, time for loving kindness meditation, this last practice. Sit up, and it's time to do loving kindness meditation, right? To lead it's my job, right? So I'm going to sit there, try to let go of the conversation a little bit, and I start in a very kind of, loving kindness meditation voice, right? Okay. breathe in and out your heart, and think of loving thoughts, yourself and others, Feel that forgiveness in your heart. And then I pause, as one does in that guided meditation, so that people could feel that. And I think, boy, it just wasn't right for her to call me right before I was doing the loving kindness meditation. Okay, now think of someone you love a lot and picture them in your heart. Damn, I'm going to call her back. And not only that, she just told me this. And I was getting angrier and angrier, right? Okay, now think of another person. Bring them in your heart. Let your eyes... And it's just going back and forth in there. And fortunately, I'd done some meditation before that. And I knew, you know, that my mind was capable of anything, including that. Mind has no pride, and it will do anything, right? And so it went on like that for most of the meditation. And sort of by the end, I was laughing quite a bit myself somehow inside, although still annoyed some as well. But I went to call her back, and it had sort of cleared out some of that. We have everything in us. Love and joy and cruelty and greed and hatred and connectedness. I have a friend who is another Jewish man who'd done a lot of reading and studying, trying to come to terms with the Jewish tradition and his own background, and particularly what had happened in the Second World War and all of the Nazi history and so forth. And this was many years ago in the 60s. He went to a friend who was studying to be a rabbi, studying kind of mystical things. He decided he would take some LSD, do an LSD trip. His friend, this guy who was going to be a rabbi, was going to sit for him. And somewhere in the middle of the trip, as he was going through all the things that can happen on LSD, and all the different images and experiences came, and wrestling with his identity that he'd taken kind of to wrestle with in this trip as a Jewish man and so forth, he looked over at his friend, this man just about to be a rabbi, kind of bearded and wearing this shawl, and he looked at him and he hated him. And the man, he said, looked to him ugly and stupid and vile, like vermin, he said. And he just hated him, and he could see that there was nothing good, it was just something horrible, and he could imagine the extinction of that kind of person. And all of a sudden, to his amazement and horror, he realized that Hitler wasn't something he had to come to terms with outside of himself. Remember Alexander Solzhenitsyn again. If only it were so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere else insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were just necessary to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who among us is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart? How much mercy and compassion it takes to really open ourselves. When the Buddha sat, as we do as Buddhas, with his eyes and his heart open in the midst of all things, he spoke the truth. He said, hatred never ceases by hatred. This is the eternal law. It doesn't end in that way. It goes from one generation to another of sorrow. And he wept tears for so many beings who want to be happy and yet create suffering because they don't know how to be happy. They do the things that create sorrow. I talk sometimes about my teacher and friend, Gosananda, the Cambodian monk, worked with in the refugee camps. I had a very difficult conversation with him some time ago after he worked in the refugee camps, and he's led walks, peace walks throughout Cambodia, kind of the Gandhi of Cambodia. He spends part of his year here in America working with Cambodian refugees as well. And he said in this phone conversation that he was called in to mediate at several Cambodian temples because there were youth gangs and fighting over the ownership of the temple and guns that were coming in. And the recreation of the war in Cambodia between factions in the Cambodian refugee community here in America. And it was such a painful thing to hear because there was so much suffering that they had run from and escaped from. And to have it again recreated from those same forces, greed and fear, prejudice. And I said, what do you do? And he said, there's not much I can do. I go to the temples. I sit down. I tell them the truth again and again. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law. To know this, to have it nourished or grow in ourselves, in our breath, our heart, our cells, to connect with that truth, the capacity for loving kindness then grows. And we remember what we're here for. As Martin Luther King said, I still believe that standing up for the truth is the greatest thing in the world. This is the end of life. The end of life is not to be happy. The end of life is not to achieve pleasure and avoid pain. The end of life is to do the will of God and to love every human being, come what may. So at the end of life, one may well ask the question, after all the dance is done for this particular birth, did I love well? Did I love this life? Myself, those around me, the earth. And each of us, in our own way, can sense this potential, the possibility for greater love, compassion, the freedom of heart, and the ease that great love brings in the midst of anything. And many of us can sense perhaps a longing for that, a wish for that to be fulfilled within us. This is a key, a kind of centerpiece to the psychology of Buddhism, to see this truth and to know what we really long for is our own true identity, to live from our Buddha nature, from our love. Life is short. How can we quarrel? Remember that passage from Don Juan. Death is our eternal companion. It is always at our left, at an arm's length. It has always been watching you, and it always will until the day you die, until the day it taps you. The thing to do when you're impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just catch the feeling that your companion is there watching you. So again, words from the Buddha, life is so short. Knowing this, how can you quarrel? How can you hold on? Now the truth is also that there is immense sorrow in the world. Warfare, injustice, hunger, racism. The world is filled with it in many, many ways and places. As much as the beauty of the world is its sorrows. And this may be the first time in human history that the greatest disasters that we face are not the natural ones of earthquakes and hurricanes and diseases, but the greatest for most human beings are man-made. I use that word quite deliberately. The destruction of the environment, the kinds of weaponry that we sell as a nation, the largest purveyor of arms ever on the face of the earth, and so forth. So the sufferings of the world are caused by the human heart, by greed, prejudice, fear, hatred, by this grasping that we have. Yet those very forces are fundamentally false. You never can possess anything. Try it. Try possessing your children. See what happens. Or your car for a long time. You know? Or even your body. The mind creates this illusion of separateness and looks for safety. But there is another way, and that's what this psychology points to, a way of being. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, if you want to see the brave, look for those who can return love for hatred. If you want to see the heroic, look for those who can forgive. To see the world with the eyes of our Buddha nature, with the eyes of a Buddha. The tree shelters and shades even the woodsman whose axe cuts it down. As we sit, as we learn to meditate, breath, body, feelings, mind, all of this, there comes a kind of healing, first to ourselves, a learning of trust of our heart, an opening of all the shadowy places, that which is closed in us, what's unfinished. And learning this capacity to sit in the midst of it all. What in yourself do you not love? So many things hidden away we wouldn't tell. But is that the truth of who you are? Those judgments, fears. As we awaken or reawaken this inherent nature of loving kindness of our Buddha nature, we discover that our heart can hold all things, can bear all things, can touch the sorrows and grief and pain and judgment, all of those things, and still love. Probably the most visited temple in our nation at this time is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. It really is a sacred place. The Smithsonian now has a whole building just filled with the offerings that people have left at the wall. Poems and words, service medals, pictures, like one would at a temple. I came down today to pay respects to two good friends of mine. Go down and visit them sometime. They're on panel 42E, lines 22 and 26. I think you'll like them. These are messages left on the wall. Your name is on a black wall in D.C., but I'm sorry to say that it's a little below ground, kind of how the enemy was. You overlook a nice green, a place like where we used to play football back at home. A lot of people walk by all day. You can tell which ones are the vets. We're the ones who don't have to ask about the size or type of stone used to make the wall. We just stand and look and weep, not caring who sees us cry, just like no one cared when we died. It's one of the few places in America where you can see people weep and grieve honestly and openly in public. If I could, I would lead each person in hand past this monument and make them read each name and imagine each life that was cut short. Was someone's mother who wrote that. And yet this monument, this wall, this temple really is a testament to the capacity of the heart and the necessity of loving kindness in the world, needed as much as air. Just wanted you to know that I love you, brother. Still talk to Kathy and your babies. They're grown now and proud of you. Somehow I feel like you're part of me. I'll always watch over them for you best as I can. I'll see you soon, brother. Just thought I'd let you know everything is okay. Loving kindness meditation is also a practice as well as a truth of our being. There's a systematic cultivation to awaken or remember or touch that within us. It was first taught in the forests by the Buddha when some monks took his instructions to sit and be aware, went into a dark part of the woods where there were caves and heard the sounds of wild animals, ghosts, and beasts, came running back and said they were frightened and asked for protection. And the Buddha said, I will give you the great protection, the true protection in life, and gave them the instructions to cultivate a heart of all-pervading friendliness and loving-kindness toward all beings. I remember when I was in the forest monastery, and there were still a lot of stories of monks in the forests and tigers and things like that. And one of my teachers laughed. He said, there are lots of tigers and nobody gets hurt. He said, you have to be a lot more careful when you drive or go in the marketplace these days, not to speak of our army. The great protection. These red cords that we give in ceremonies sometimes are called protection cords. The protection of the refuges or precepts or whatever. I remember being together with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. We were doing some teaching and a protection cord ceremony. One of the people there said, well, what exactly do these protect you from? You take certain vows and things when you get this. And he said, why, yourself, of course. The only thing that you really need protection from. So loving kindness is a truth, like sunlight, like gravity. It's what makes us alive. And it has a power when it moves in us. The power, you know, the stories of mothers lifting cars off babies and things like that. Unbelievable and true. Or teachers that I've met who have awakened this sense in themselves. Sometimes I remember being around this one Tibetan Lama, Karmapa. And there was a field within 10 feet of him or so. I'd get close to him and there was just this tremendous sense of happiness that would just come over my body and mind. Like going to the Caribbean on a cold, wet, wintry day. All of a sudden I was in Martinique or St. John's or some one of those places. In a second, it was amazing. Or Deepa Ma, this wonderful old yogi and grandmother in India, who would keep her money under her mattress, you know, and ask, how's your mother and father? And take out a little money, like a dollar, and say, go buy them a present and send your parents something. And that was kind of the way she taught. A little diminutive person, and she'd come before you'd leave. And the Bengalis do this. It was in Bengal. And she'd give you a big hug, you know, and bless you, all these blessings. And I would leave, and I would just be stoned for a day. Like, wow, what a blessing. It's contagious, loving kindness, you know. And it's very immediate, and it happens in the smallest little ways. In a conversation, the tone of voice, whether it's a tone of fear or protectedness or trying to kind of cut your best deal, right? Or whether it's a tone and the eyes of interest or caring, connectedness. Just in a moment, people feel it. Like Mother Teresa sending people home from India who come to work with her, saying, you know, all right, you've learned something here in Calcutta. Now go home and try it in your family and with your neighbors and in your community. Very immediate. Like this mother in a class some weeks ago here was talking in one of the old students' groups about what a busy time it was, and she's a single mom with two young kids and trying to work and take care of the kids and get home and cook and whatever, and the kids were fighting with one another and very needy and whatever, and she was doing something one day and she really hurt her back terribly and had to lie down and couldn't even hardly move for a week. Couldn't even get up to cook for them, really. They ate, you know, cereal and milk that week. She said, and there I was lying on the mattress in the living room with my kids. She said, and you know what? Turned out to be one of the best weeks of my life. She said they weren't needy. I was just there. I paid attention to them, which is really what they needed and wanted. They didn't fight very much. They would bring the milk and the Cheerios out of the refrigerator, right? Help cook as best as they could. Not big things. Just here. One of the greetings that's traditional in Tibet is to put your forehead against another person's forehead. It was a wonderful greeting. It's kind of hold your two heads together. Poem from Rumi. If anyone asks you how the perfect satisfaction of all our sexual wanting will look, lift your face and say, like this. When someone mentions the gracefulness of the night sky, climb up on the roof and dance and say, like this, in a moment. If anyone wants to know what spirit is or what God's fragrance means, lean your head toward him or her. Touch foreheads. Keep your face there close, like this. When somebody quotes the old poetic image of the clouds gradually uncovering the moon, slowly loosen knot by knot the strings of your robe, like this. If anyone wonders how Jesus raised the dead, don't try to explain the miracle. Kiss them on the lips, like this. When someone asks, what is there to do? Light the candle in their hands, like this. When I first started to teach as a meditation teacher, because I was a lot younger than now, 20 years ago or so, and I'd practiced in a very energetic way a lot, I tried to get people to do that. And I was pretty impatient. I wanted everybody to do it, get concentrated and have all these experiences and so forth. And gradually, over the years, I learned that didn't serve people very well. And it didn't work very well. I mean, it's fine to put in a kind of dignity and directness in one's meditation. But much more what's required is patience. St. Francis de Sales says, what you need is a cup of understanding, a barrel of love, and an ocean of patience. Which is another aspect of this friendliness or kindness. Not how things are supposed to be or how the Pillsbury biscuits are going to be compared to your own, but a patience with things as they are. If we have all powers and the faith to move mountains, but not love, we are as clanging cymbals, St. Paul. And this patience, it's not an easy thing. And it's not sentimental. It's really one of the hardest things, to love things that are there as they are. And I also don't mean to be passive or that one doesn't respond when there's injustice, but to respond with love. It's not sentimental at all. I remember being with my father when he had his first major heart attack more than 10 years ago. And he was in the hospital. We all came, my brothers and my mother and I, and spending time with him. He was in the hospital for an intensive care for a month and a half. And in the midst of it, they were giving him very little chance of living. His kidneys had stopped. His liver function wasn't working. All kinds of things. And he had all the totally intubated and all the monitors and everything. And they said, maybe he's got 5% chance to make it through the next few days. So I went in to see him. I've been in and out, thinking, well, it's one of the last times I get to talk with him. He was not an easy person to talk to in many ways. And I went up to him and got his attention. He was a little bit out of it. And then I said to him, after talking a little bit, I said, you know, Dad, I love you. And he looked at me, you don't say that in our family. It's not something that one says. He looked at me, and even though he had all these tubes and things in his arms, he raised his arm and he put his fingers to his nose like he was smelling something really bad, and he shook his head like that. And it was really kind of an amazing moment because he was so true to character, right? At the last, he was just himself, right? You just don't say that. You don't go a life not saying it and then say it. It's not the right thing in his book anyway, you know. I remember telling that story in one men's retreat, and all the guys cheered, you know, it's strong genes you come from. So it's not about being sentimental. People are who they are. You've noticed, I hope. Right? But it's really about a respect from your heart for this amazing display of life that we participate in. And loving kindness allows our consciousness to rest in the heart. It generally begins, when one does it as a systematic practice, with forgiveness. Just to clear the heart, to let go of the past. Forgiveness means to let go of the barriers, the hatred that we carry. It doesn't mean in forgiveness that you paper things over. It can be a long process of rage and sorrow and anger and loss and grief. And to forgive doesn't mean you condone something in the past, that it was okay. You may say, never again, I will put my own body in the way of allowing that to happen with another person. Forgiveness is simply saying that we won't put someone else out of our heart. That we let go of the enemy because it hurts us too much to make enemies in ourselves. So in loving kindness meditation, you begin with yourself, often then a benefactor or loved ones, neutral persons. Finally, at the end, you work with including your enemies or the people most difficult. And it's done at the end because what happens is you feel love and kindness. You know, the people that you picture first are the ones you care most about, and your heart opens and you feel the sweetness for the world and those. And then you picture this person who you hate. And immediately your heart goes, it just kind of shrivels like that. And you feel the pain of that hatred. And you realize it's just too painful. It just doesn't make any sense to who we really are. It's a practice, and you do it over and over. Forgiveness and loving kindness. Teachers I had said, you know, do it a few times a day for the next 6 months, 1,000 times maybe. Let me know how it's going. And it brings up everything. It's opposites. You get angry. You feel dull. You feel like you couldn't love anything. You're dried up. You don't want to forgive. And all those are part of just reciting and practicing and holding your heart with compassion. You do it in traffic. It's good. On airplanes, especially when it gets a little rocky there. Christmas rush. Loving kindness meditation. I took a walk the other day at the Santa Sabina retreat where I was with another teacher, friend, and there was this house that said open house. It was Saturday. This big kind of mansion. I said, oh, let's go in. It'll be fun to see what it looks like. Pretend we're going to buy $1 million or whatever. So we went in and looked around, and I signed the register. The realtor said, would you sign this? I said, sure. Put my name down. She said, oh, you're Jack Kornfield. I read your book. Well, she said, and the thing I liked in that was the loving kindness meditation. She said, so I've been doing it today. As people come in to see the house, I'll just wish each one well. May you be well. May you be peaceful. May your life have well-being of body and mind. And here was this realtor, you know, up in San Rafael doing that. It's fantastic practice. The blessings that come, sweet dreams. The sutra says you fall asleep easily. You waken contented. Your health is good. Angels love and protect you, and men and women love you. Weapons won't harm you when your heart fills with loving kindness. Poisons won't work. And if you lose things, they're returned to you. You have a beautiful rebirth. People welcome you everywhere. Animals will sense it and love you. Your babies are happy in the womb and when they grow up. And if you fall off a cliff, a tree will always be there to catch you.
This concludes part 9 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Please turn the tape over for part 10.